I will turn it over to Alan. Alan, take us away.
Okay, thanks, Chris, and good evening, everyone. And actually, I'm going to start off with Chris. So here's the first slide for you, Chris.
Okay, yeah. Tom actually introduced this idea a while ago, and I checked, and there was no way for us to enable live transcripts on Zoom. And I was looking at something else today, and all of a sudden, we do have the ability to do transcripts. So if you want a transcript of what you hear people saying, you can do so. So if you go to the Zoom controls toolbar and you click on more next, and then you click on captions in the pop-up that comes up, and then you click on show captions next, you will end up having a caption running just above the rest of the tools on the toolbar. As people are speaking, you will see the transcription there. Just reading a transcript would be great for people who are hard of hearing or whatever, but what people probably really want is to save the transcript. So next, if you want to do that, you go back to that more captions and you choose view full transcript next, and you will get a separate panel similar to the participants or the chat, which will be called transcript, and all of the transcript will be in that panel next. And at the bottom of that, you have a save transcript button, and so you can save that transcript to your computer. So if you're interested, you can now get live transcripts going on our Zoom meetings. That's it.
Thanks, Chris. Okay. Sorry, so the next item on the agenda is a couple of apps that Jeff Dubois is recommending. And this will bring Jeff's smartphone apps to a close. So if anybody has any other programs which they can't live without, let us know. So tonight, Jeff is indicating that there's a really good text editing program called the Old School Editor. And he said it's the best Android editor that he's found, reminiscent of the old QEdit from the DOS days, if anybody remembers that. So Jeff has it in his Essentials folder. I tried it out quickly, and it surely is just a basic text editor, but it works really, really well. And the second thing, Jeff likes to listen to Ottawa Morning on CBC Radio, 91.5 FM. However, that doesn't work when he's at in the sticks at his cottage in the middle of nowhere. And the problem is he can pick up CBC Kingston from there, but they carry the Ontario Morning regional edition, which he says is insufferable. So his answer has been to download the CBC Listen app and call up Radio 1 Ottawa over the internet and then pipe the results through a Bluetooth speaker. So CBC Listen is available on the internet if you can't access it directly from the radio. Okay, there's nothing new here. I just want to note that after Christmas, I was checking my phone and looked at the messages, and I noticed that there was some in the blocked category. And when I looked, I find that, well, not all scams, they're not all telephone calls, and they're not all emails. I'm getting a whole raft of SMS text messages, and you see here it's the usual suspects, and people are depositing money to my bank, and I just have to click here to accept it. And I'm getting tax refunds, hundreds of tax refunds from the Canada Revenue Agency, and all kinds of incompetent couriers can't deliver packages to my front door, and I have to contact them. So they're pretty obvious scams if you look at those kind of things, but just be aware that SMS text messaging is another issue out there. And our Fraud Watch page lists a whole raft of stuff, which if you don't know about them, you should take a look. Okay, next item on the agenda is a question from Allison, and Chris is going to talk about email impersonators.
Yeah, just before we go on, we have a couple of comments that people who don't have more next to whiteboard on the toolbar. It should be somewhere on the toolbar. I may be getting more because I've got extra things on there. So if you just look along on your toolbar and see if you have anything that is related to captions.
Yes, it's near the middle called show captions. You can choose either to see the captions or you can choose to have the full transcript going alongside.
Yeah, so it's just that I guess my toolbar, there's not enough room for it, so it's stuck on it anymore. So if you don't see it, just look for the actual tool on the toolbar itself.
Chris, I have on my laptop, a participant has enabled closed captioning. Who can see this transcript recording on? It's at the top of my screen.
Yeah, it just comes up to warn you that closed captioning, like somebody went ahead and turned that on. And so they're just letting you know that it's a transcript is being captured, so maybe don't swear or something like that, or maybe swear a lot of extras or something. I don't know. Anyhow, let's go move on. So email impersonation. So the question that came in from Allison, you know, why do I get emails with the name of one of my contacts in the from field when the sender says they didn't send it? And was wondering whether this is something they really needed to worry about or not. Next. So the first thing that you have to realize is that email is unauthenticated. So it is really, really easy for anybody to spoof what it says the email came from. Now, there have been some attempts to have various means of authenticating email. None of them work really well, and few of them work even decently. So absolutely you cannot trust the from address on an email. Spammers, scammers, they will send you emails that purport to come from any other address because they don't want you complaining back to them about their spam. So next. So if you're at all suspicious about an email, and the things to look for are, you know, your urge to open an attachment. That's a real red flag. You get directed to another website. You know, so they're trying to send you somewhere where your computer is going to get compromised, or you're going to be prompted for personal information or something like that. Or even ask directly in the email itself for sensitive personal information. Or if you find that, this email came from somebody and it just doesn't feel right. You know, the wording doesn't seem like them and so forth. All of these things are things that should flag you as, you know, to you as being suspicious email. So what do you do? Next. So verify it with the person who said they sent it. So if you get it from Sam Spade, then you get in touch with Sam and say, you know, did you really mean to send me this email? Was it really from you? Now, use some other method other than replying to the email. If it turns out that that person's email was really hacked, guess what the answer is going to be if you write back to that address and says, did you mean to send this to me? Or are you a hacker? Oh, no, I'm not a hacker. I'm your friend. So phone them, text them, or use an alternate email address, some other method that you can get in touch with that person to verify it. Next. So the other thing that you should consider is whether you should advise the supposed sender that maybe they need to do something. Like maybe their email was actually hacked or something like that. So should you actually do something to help this other person out? So just the fact that it was spoofed is certainly not proof that their email was hacked. Anybody can spoof it, okay? But the converse isn't true. It's not proof that they weren't hacked, so it could actually be that their email got hacked. So I would actually encourage the supposed sender to check for some kind of evidence that they were actually hacked. So they should check, was their password reset? That's usually pretty obvious to them because they can't get into their email. But the second one is a really tricky one, auto-forwarding to another address added to the account. It's really trivial in a lot of email accounts such as Gmail. You can go in and you can set it so that every incoming email gets auto-forwarded to another account. It's not apparent to you when you're using your email that all these emails that come in are getting sent to another address. Why would an attacker do that? Well, what if you do a password reset? and the new password or the link to do a reset on your other account somewhere is sent to your email of record. So it comes in, the hacker gets a copy of it, and they can jump on that. Okay, they can also find out all kinds of other information about you that can help them further their hack on you. Have them look to see whether the sent folder has items that they didn't send. This would be pretty rare because anybody worth their salt is not going to send from your email address and leave evidence in your sent item folder, but it's not a bad thing to check. My apologies. And so the... This is an opportunity, I think, for you to help out these people to make sure that, you know, there are standard things that they can do. And I've pasted these all into the chat as well. So other articles that we've had, presentations we've given, Q&A sessions we've had, all talking about these things. So keeping passwords safe, how to good passwords, how to protect them, how to get a, you know, password strength. What does that really mean? There are a bunch of non-technical safeguards that people can take care of, you know, word of password day, you know, how to do password resets and things like that. So this, if it's somebody who you think can benefit from some additional guidance, by all means, send on these links to them and help them, you know, protect their computing environment. And that's it.
Thanks, Chris. On the issue of unwanted things, I have a Samsung smartphone, and it just got an over-the-air update to Android 13. And the next time I booted the phone up, I get this notice that I have to unlock the secure folder in order to get notifications. Well, I don't use the secure folder, so I was wondering what was happening. And it turns out lots of people on the web are similarly wondering what's happening. They're really upset. They have to do things every time that they boot their computer. And they're a bit concerned that this is advertising that there is a secure folder on their phone. Not sure why that's a huge problem. But so anyway, it turns out that in addition to all kinds of people being upset, there's at least one person who knows how to fix it. And it turns out this is one of the Samsung apps that you can actually get rid of. So if you run secure folder and unlock it using your regular PIN, then go to the more settings, three dots series of things, which we've just been talking about Zoom. But if you find settings and then more settings, you will find that there is an uninstall option and you can get rid of secure folder, which in my view is a good thing to do, make it go away forever. So if you're having that notification or no notification problem, that's one way to fix it. Okay, Chris has got some information on a new keyboard shortcut.
This is something that Jeff Dubois posted to the member forum. So those who are not on the member forum, this is sort of helpful information you might find periodically gets posted there. So Bob Hares began a series on keyboard shortcuts going back last November, and he prompted everybody to come up with their own favorite shortcuts that they might share. So I would reiterate on that and say if you have a shortcut that you use an awful lot and you find that maybe not everybody knows about it or uses it, you know, good opportunity to share it with other people. So this one from Jeff was that if you hold down Control, Alt, Shift, and the Windows key, it will actually go to Microsoft 365 Online. So this is free apps, as well as there's paid versions that you can do as well. But you can actually log into here using any Microsoft account and use the online versions of Word, PowerPoint, and Excel. So it will open up your default browser, and it will go to Office.com. Now, of course, yes, you can just browse to Office.com, and you get to the same spot. But if you want to hold down those four keys, it'll pop you into it right away.
Okay, and Chris, the next couple of slides are yours too.
Okay, Windows 11 moments. This is one of those, oh my God, Microsoft, you got to be kidding me. Microsoft used to go through what was a pretty standard progression in bringing in new features into Windows. And so everything started off in the Insider program. and they had the dev channel, which was really bleeding edge stuff. Then they went to beta channel, and then it went to the insider release preview, and then it went to a public preview update. And each one of these, they hoped that they were getting more and more bugs fixed as it went through that, as people were finding, you know, different combinations of software or hardware might have actually caused some problems. So it went through this sort of four-stage pre-release. So hopefully most of the things would get caught that were bad. And then it went out to the stable cumulative updates, such as 22H1, 22H2, and so forth. Well, this seems to have gone the way of the dodo bird. Next. We are now getting moments. And this is Microsoft's terminology for it. It consists of largely unannounced changes. Next. You'll get things like the tab file explorer. That came about as a moment. It didn't go through the dev channel, beta channel, release preview. It just all of a sudden popped in. And taskbar overflow, new photos app, all these sort of things. They're bringing out these new features without going through this progression of testing. And it seems they don't really feel that testing is as needed anymore. Next. Now, the only identifiable way that you can find out when these things happen is the OS build number. And then you can find out under the OS build number, if you search at Microsoft, you'll find out where changes are made in particular builds. But yeah, I think it's kind of crazy what they've done. They've gone and just totally gone away from a standard progression of more and more testing. And I think that we're going to see more and more things come out that are buggy on first release, that every consumer is going to see it same time. Okay, this one here, this is something that was forwarded by Eldon Gaw and the Open Media folks. They are having tomorrow night a conversation on privacy in public space. So if you're interested in this sort of thing, it's being live streamed to the YouTube channel. And I will paste this into the chat window as well. You can see on the screen a bunch of the people that are going to be guests on it, or part of the panel discussion, I guess, is what it's really going to be all about. It is fairly late, so it starts at 10 p.m., and they say it's running for 3 hours. But if you're interested, the URL is there and in the chat, so fill your boots.
Okay, thanks, Chris. Okay, so the next item is kind of a follow-up on all of the stuff that we've been talking about at Q&A and also in the members forum on ChatGPT. You recall that most people have been looking at this as a way to write text, so writing articles on a certain subject, and the AI bot basically writes the text for you. This YouTube video by David Bombal, he basically looked at using the AI bot to produce computer code. And he tried a number of different programming languages and parameters, and found that it would actually work quite well. So I actually tried this out myself. You recall that we have an index to the Q&A topics over the past 3 years on the website. So I have copied those lists of topics and put them into a LibreOffice Writer text file, which is an ODT file. And then every week you'll notice that there's an agenda comes out and gets sent to you by email. And that's basically a simple text file, an ASCII text file. So what I need to do is to take the new topics from this week and add them to the end of the ODT file. So I thought I would write a LibreOffice basic macro to do that. And the way I write macros is I go to Google and search for different modules that I need, pieces of code that I need, and then I modify the results, string them all together, and debug it until I have a working macro. And so that's what I did. And the problem, of course, is that I know how to read and write lines from a text file, but what I didn't know was, how do you do that with an ODT file? Because an ODT file isn't simple text. It's actually a zip file, and the zip file contains a whole bunch of XML and other kinds of modules. So I had to find out how to do that. Well, I thought, well, let's try ChatGPT. So I told it exactly what it says here. Write a program in LibreOffice Basic to add a string, just one text string, to the end of an ODT file. And amazingly, it basically produces a running commentary, a kind of a tutorial on how to do it. So it says, step one, open the ODT file using the load method of the desktop object. And then it gives you the dimension statement and the component.load command with a pseudo file that tells you how to open an ODT file. And then the next thing you want to retrieve is the text object that has the body text of your file. And you do that by using the getText method. So again, you need a dimension statement and the document.getText command. And then it goes through all the steps like this, showing you exactly what to do and why you're doing it. And then the very last thing, it gives you the actual macro code. So here are the dimension statements. Here's where it opens the document, gets the text object, inserts it, goes to the end of the file, inserts the text string, and then closes the document. And basically, that mirrors exactly what I came up with by spending all kinds of time on Google trying to find out how to do these various LibreOffice Basic commands. So it's quite an amazing product. The only problem is it's free right now, but they're talking about $42 a month, I think it was, for business users. So if they take away the free version, I think that's going to price it out of the market of home individuals. Okay, moving along. Sorry, Stefan, I told you were next, but it turns out the next thing we have is you. So Stefan is going to talk about PowerShell, and you're going to unmute your microphone and share your screen. And
Okay. So I will start sharing. Hold on. Okay, you should see my title.
Perfect.
Okay.
Yes.
So we'll start with a few definitions first. The first thing is, in computing, a shell, and you will understand why it's called PowerShell, is a computer program that exposes an operating system services to a human user or other program. Most of these shells use a command line interpreter or a command line processor, and they use a command line interface to receive commands from a user in the form of line of text. And many users rely on graphical user interface, like in Windows. Most of the time, if you want to change a setting, you go through the graphical user interface of using settings and stuff like that with menu-driven interaction. However, some programming language and maintenance tasks may not have a graphical user interface and use a command line. Windows has a bunch of command line to do most of the things that you can do with the graphical user interface of Windows. Programs with command line interface are generally easier to automate via scripting because they are using text as input, so you can just put the text that you want with the proper command. And the window command line or the DOS prompt is an example of a shell. So, a bit of background on PowerShell. Way back in 2001, Microsoft started working on something to replace the aging DOS command prompt, shell and batch file, i.e. the script, and to have a new way of develop script. PowerShell is a task automation and a configuration management program from Microsoft, consisting of a command line shell and the associated scripting language. So I'll give you an example of that in the next few slides. In 2006, so 5 years later, Microsoft released version 1 of PowerShell programming language. In 2016, so 10 years later, it was made open source and cross-platform. So it was originally developed for Windows, but now you can basically use the same program, the same command that will work on a Mac OS or in some distribution of Linux. So you learn once and you can reuse it on many platforms. Commandlet are specialized command in the PowerShell environment that implement specific function, and we'll see how many there are of these commands. And the PowerShell scripts are saved in a text file with an extension of .ps1. So what are the current version of PowerShell? In Windows 10 shipped or come with PowerShell version 5.1 installed, and there's another program called the Windows PowerShell Integrated Scripting Environment, ISE. You can get the current version of PowerShell is PowerShell version 7.1. It's available to be downloaded and installed on your PC. For the Windows PowerShell, so this is a tool that can be used to create, run, and debug. The main reason that I will be using an integrated scripting environment is because of the debug feature. Because you can run the script, put a breakpoint somewhere in the script that you want to run. You can say run to that breakpoint, and after that you can go line by line in your script to debug and find out what is happening. So that's very useful to do that. But you can do a lot just with the regular command prompt in PowerShell. However, that specific tool is no longer in active feature development, and they say that there is no plan to remove ISE from Windows, but we'll see in Windows 11 what they do. If they remove it from Windows, there's another free tools that you can use. It's called the Visual Studio Code, and when you install that, you run it, and you will ask you a question if you want to install the PowerShell extension, and you just say yes, and you will install that. And this allow Visual Studio Code to recognize basically the PowerShell language, and it will put all the keywords in different colors and stuff like that. In Windows 11, as of July 22, Windows Terminal as the default terminal application on Windows. That means that script, application, PowerShell, the old command prompt all run within that terminal window. And it looks something like this. When you go in your application, you will see terminal. If you click on that, you will get a window that pop out, and you already be a window open with Windows PowerShell, and you get a command prompt. If you want, you can open many more windows, many more shell if you want. And if you click, instead of clicking on the plus sign, if you click on the small arrow, the down arrow that you see here, you get a choice. So you can open yet another windows of PowerShell, or you can open the DOS command prompt, and you can open many other things that you see on the list here. So we'll look at the programming component, because like I said in the beginning, PowerShell is really a programming language. So when you're going to look at what the programming language can do, and there's some major difference between PowerShell and, if you want, programming things in DOS, if you want. First, there is these commandlet, and all of them have an alias. So instead of typing the long name of the command, like get command or something like that, there's an alias that is only one or two letters that you can type. You can define variable, and PowerShell support various type of the variable. So you can create variable that only accept integer, number, or floating point, string of characters, boolean, so basically a true or false, to deal with date and time and objects. And a lot of the powerful feature of PowerShell come from the fact that it can deal with programming objects. As we saw a few seconds ago by the presentation from Alan, they were using objects to access that file type. So in that programming language, there are conditional statements. You can do if something, then do something else. You can also do a switch statement. So a switch statement is very useful if you have like 10 things that you want to test to figure out what option the user has selected. Instead of doing if then else statement, you can use switch and can list all of these options. And the switch statement is the most powerful that I've seen. It's more powerful than what I saw in C or in Visual Basic. You can do a loop if you need to repeat a piece of code. If you know exactly how many times you want to repeat the loop, there is a for statement, so you can indicate I want to repeat that loop of instruction 10 times, for example. Or you can do it until using the while, and the while will do the instruction you put there as long as some variable or something remains true. Or you can do the reverse. You can do a set of instruction while something remains true, or you can use for each. And this one is very powerful because you can use an object with that, and you can say, for example, for each item in this object, do the following, and it will go through all the various items in that. One thing that you need to notice in DOS batch file, we use a lot go to, because there's none of these. There's a for, but there's not these other more recent, like while, do while, for each exists also. But you use a lot of go-to to navigate through your batch file. In PowerShell, there is no go-to, so you need to use all of these modern programming methods if you want. You can create arrays of all of these data types, or hash table of all of these data type. And the difference between the two is an array. When you create it, you define the size. And you say, for example, I want an array that can contain 10 integer value. And you access them by giving like one, item 1, 2, 3, and so forth. In the hash table, you can use a key that can be anything to access a specific element in that table. So you can use a name, you can use a code, you can use whatever. So that's the main difference between these two type of array if you want. You can define your own custom function, so you can create more commandlet. You can also create more object, also known as class in programming language, and commandlet based on these objects. Most of the commandlet operate on objects. You can customize the console, so you can change the font color, the size, the background color, all of these things, clear the screen. You can get user input, like if the user press a key, or if you type something, or if you move the mouse, you can get all of these input and do something with it. You can control the cursor if you want the cursor to stay in one spot. Like, for example, if you are want to show a progress bar that the percentage is increasing, but you want the cursor to stay there and override that number, you can do that with function to do that. You can do background processing, so you can start a job if you want that you're going to send in the background. The computer will keep executing that thing in the background. You can get status where they are. You can stop it, and you can all the functions to deal with these are available through PowerShell. You can do networking. You can do file processing. Obviously, you can do text file, but it's also support XML. I've seen the COMO, the file that we use when we export things from Excel, we support that too. You can play sound, you can like, it's not only a beat, but you can do like the duration and all kinds of things. Regular expression is when you're dealing with text strings. This is a very powerful feature that you can tell, I'm looking for the following pattern, for example, text item that start with the letter R and finish with the letter Z or something like that. So regular expression, it's its own language on its own, fairly complex. You can do error and exception handling. You can do data parsing, so when you get a string of something, you can easily find, like for example, if you get a string that has an IP address somewhere in that string and you want to get that out because you want to send something onto that network address, the data parsing feature allow you to go and get that IP address relatively easy, and much more. So let's talk about the commandlet, what it looks like. So PowerShell use a verb and noun name pair to name commandlet. So it's always a verb dash and a name to help us remember what the command do. For example, the get command, commandlet in PowerShell will get you all the commandlet commands that are registered in PowerShell, in the version that you're using. You can also add a custom commandlet with the associated helm information for a specific format. If you follow the format and you put it in a specific directory, when you start PowerShell, it will load that command. It will be available. If you do a get command, you will see your command in the list. By using the pipe symbol, and that's the straight line on your keyboard, you can send the output of one commandlet to another one. And we see that a lot in PowerShell. On the next slide, I will show you an example of what PowerShell looked like. And we're going to use two of these commands. The first one is to get command to get the list of the command. And the next one, it's a command line called measure object. And as its name implies, it measures things about objects, and we'll see what we can do with that. And I want to use these two to figure out how many commandlets are installed. So this should work. So this is what the command prompt when you start PowerShell will look like. You get a window and you get what it is, and you get a prompt and with a cursor flashing there. So I recorded that video, so hopefully this will work. So typing the command, get command, pressing enter. And I don't know if anyone was at time to count how many rows. Only thing I can say, there's a lot. So now what I want to do, I want to be able to count how many of these commands that command has displayed. So I use the same command as before, get command and the pipe. So I will take the output. So basically all that information will be sent to the next command. And this one is called measure object. And we need to tell what we want to measure about what is coming in. And one of the parameters that you can use is dash line. And when you do that, you press enter. So that command will run, so that information we just saw, and it will send it to the measure object. And what the measure object will do, it will just count the number of lines. And you can count many other things depending on what the parameters you add at the end of the command. So in that case, the output that is given is the number of line was 1,879. So that's a lot of command that already exists in PowerShell. And you notice that PowerShell put the command in yellow automatically. And so when he thinks it's a commandlet, he will put it in yellow. And the thing that it will do for the parameters, it will put them in light gray. So you will notice that the line, that color here is different than the white here, and it's not yellow. MS-DOS has 59 commands compared to 1,879 PowerShell. So right there, you can see that PowerShell is way, way more powerful of the things you can do. They have a list of approved verb that they want people to use when they're creating new commands, so they get some kind of configuration. So you can get that also by using a command, and the command is get verb. So if you type get verb, you will get a list similar that on the other screen with 98 rows. So there's 98 if you want approved verbs. And I just typed them here, so I won't read all of them. Like the get command is here. So instead of typing get, I could type just J. All of them do something, but we still, to get a complete command, we still need to get a noun associated with that. So the next thing I would like to know is, for example, how many nouns are associated with the get command? So to get all the noun, I can, with the verb get, I can just use get help. So the verb is get and the noun is help. And the parameters I'm looking for verb and the verb I'm looking for is get. So if I type this on PowerShell and type enter, I'm getting a list of 477 rows. So there's a lot of things that you can get. And the get command is probably the one that has the most now. Most of these other two, when I run the command without specifying a verb, just to get the list of all the names, some of them are only one or two noun that were associated with them, but get had a lot. In terms of resources, if you want to learn more about PowerShell, The first one is the built-in get help commandlet. So if you know what you're looking for, you should be able to get information. If you know the exact command, you can put get help in the name of the commandlet, and it will give you how to use it, the various options, the parameters you can use, example, you can get a whole lot of information. Obviously, you can use Google. You can use ChatGPT, and as Alan showed us, it worked very well. Like the example he gave us was in another software, but he also worked with PowerShell. There's a book that I read. It's called PowerShell for Beginners by Ian Walters. Highly recommended. No programming knowledge required. And directly from the introduction of the book, Ian said, through this book, you are going to start with the very basics and learn what tools you need and how script can be structured and how you can write code to perform the tasks you need and build your own useful set of PowerShell tools. And he really started, the first chapter is how to install PowerShell, how to install the Visual Studio Code thing to debug the program. So it's very, very well written, and he shows everything that you need to build up to. In fact, the last chapter is he shows us how to do a game in using PowerShell, which is pretty cool. But I found many other books. If you do a query on Google and you say PowerShell book PDF, a free book PowerShell PDF, you will get a long list of books that you can get for free basically and look at them. But most of them I found that, like, this is an example, like that free book Learning PowerShell. And the author were Stack Overflow contributors. So I guess there's not one person that wrote, like, contributed to that book. But after a short introduction, I think chapter 2, they were talking already about Active Directory, and the next one after that was talking about how to get Amazon Web Services. It's funny that the first book, if you don't know anything about programming or anything about PowerShell to read, but it gives you an idea of how powerful PowerShell can be to, if you're using Active Directory to configure your computers. There's ways to control Active Directory with PowerShell. And if you are using Amazon Web Services, you can control that also with PowerShell. So, depending on what you need to do, there's probably a chapter in a book somewhere that is covering it. My personal experience, I've been using MS-DOS and Windows command line for about 37 years. I'm not a system administrator, so I do not use it every day. So I still have to look up the proper syntax for many commands, like the for commands, but the if statement in the bash file, I always have to go, what is the specific syntax that I need to use? I find that the DOS command prompt is really picky about syntax. You need to write it exactly correct, space, no space, tab, that kind of stuff. Well, nothing works. Debugging MS-DOS file is a nightmare. I need to comment out instruction until I find the offending one, at least with the PowerShell. And if you use the integrated environment, you can put a breakpoint in your script and you can run it up to that point. After that, you can go line by line, figure out where the thing stopped working. Many months ago, I did a presentation on my DOS backup batch file that I'm using, and I wanted to add at the end of the batch file the disk-free space to the log file. I was able to do it, but it's not really pretty, so I get a bunch of white space, two deer, and I finally get how many byte-free are on that disk. So it was not really pretty, but I just gave up trying to make it look the way I wanted. What I wanted, basically, it's something that was going to tell me like 2.7 gigabytes or terabytes or something like that. And I wanted that information in a variable so I can test it. Like if the free space is bigger than this, okay, fine, do nothing. But if it's smaller than whatever amount, display something in the log or send me an email or something like that. So after using batch file for 37 years, I decided to making the switch to PowerShell. So whatever new batch file I need, I will be doing it with PowerShell. I've been reading many books on PowerShell and learning how powerful the data manipulation and obtaining data from Windows to get settings, status. There is books that have like 20-25 chapters, and all of them talk about getting all kinds of status or changing settings in Windows, that kind of thing. So it's really powerful. The piping of data, in other words, using the output of one command and sending it to another, is taken to another level in PowerShell just because of the fact that most of the commandlets are using objects, and objects by default are are complex because they can get all kind of data and stuff like that inside them, but you can do a whole lot more things with them. So it really taking it to another level compared to what pipe exists in DOS, but PowerShell take it to another level. Filtering the output of a command let and to only get the data you are looking for is also very powerful. You can do a whole lot of things. The ability to document and create standard help information in any command let is also very useful, because if it's something you do often, you can code it once, and after that you can reuse it in your other script. For me, the learning curve is to learn and remember which commandlet does, and especially that most of them have parameters, and some of them have very long set of parameters, and depending on what parameter you use, you will not do the same thing. So it can get quite complex. So just the get command, we saw that there is 400 nouns or something like that you can use with it. And each of these commands have a number of parameters. So it can get quite complex and overwhelming to learn all of that. But we'll do an example. I want to get the free space for a specific drive. For example, I want to get the free space in drive D, and I want it expressed in a gigabyte and a variable so I can test the result. Like in any programming language, there's always many ways to do something. So I'm pretty sure that somebody will find a way to do it with less step, but I found a way to do it. So in the next slide, I will show you my process to get that information with a lot of trial and errors until I got it right. So the first thing was to find which get command was going to get me that information. So I went to Google and somebody said, use the following command. So it's called get sim instance, and sim is common information model. It's basically a standard that exists to report information about the computer, and Windows support that information. So that's the command, and you need to use the parameters class name and the list of class. There's a very long list of class names. There's all kind of information you can get from that CIM instance, but the class name in particular that give you the information about the disk is win32_logical_disk. So when you know all of this and you type this, you press enter, you get an output that looks something like this. Basically, it give you all the drive I have on my workstation, the volume name and the size in byte, and the free space in byte. So the information that I need is on that row and that number here. So what I can do, if I want to isolate that row, I can take the same command as we just used and use the pipe symbol to send the output, basically all of this through the where object. And now I will use an argument that is that property, device ID, the dash EQ is equate, and in a single quote, D column. So you will basically only output that row basically. And there is many other tests you can do. You can do counting, you can use regular expression, you can do like all the smaller, greater, that kind of things. So if I run that command, it just basically the same information as before, except that I have only that row that match that criteria. So basically the row for D. So making progress, getting closer to my aim, but now I want that information to be expressed in gigabyte instead of byte. So this command is a bit more complicated. So instead of displaying it, I decided to put it in a variable. And the way to define a variable in PowerShell is to start with a dollar sign. So as soon as you type the dollar sign, PowerShell will change the font color to green, And after that, whatever you type is going to be the variable name. So I called it my variable fs for a file, free space, sorry. And you put an equate sign, and PowerShell will determine automatically, depending on what you try to put in that variable, what type of variable it should be. So basically the same command as before, and the where object, same command as before, but I will pipe again the output of that single row into yet another command, command, select object. So now I want to properties, I want to select the following properties, basically. I want to select device ID and comma, and this long command here will basically create a new properties. So the name of that property is going to be free space bracket gigabyte, and the expression for the value for that column is going to be that variable here. It's a special variable in PowerShell that say use the current, whatever row is being processed by that pipe. So it will get the free space divided by, and PowerShell know about terabyte, gigabyte, kilobyte, megabyte. So he knows about these acronyms. So you can just say I want divided by 1 gigabyte, and I want to take that number and convert it. When you put like that bracket with integer, it means convert it to an integer. And that's what you will do. So, but when I press enter, nothing will happen because the result of all of this is going to be stored in that variable. If I want to know what that variable contained, I just type the name of the variable and press enter, and it will display the information. Now I'm getting very close to my end because I'm getting the free space on D drive in gigabytes, so 840. Now, I mentioned earlier that you can get various type of variable. So if you type the variable name followed by .getType, PowerShell will give you information about that variable. Like for example, when I press enter here, it will tell me that variable is public, because when you create variable, you can restrict the scope of that variable. It can maybe only be visible in that function you're using, or anything that run in PowerShell can get access to it. So it's telling me right now that this one is public, searchable. It's something to save to take the output and save it to some type of special file. The name of the object that is being used, it's a PowerShell custom object, and it's based on the system object. So that's, in fact, a variable contain an object. Now I want to extract that 840. So what I can do is use a variable name, file size, and the bracket zero, it's like accessing an array. I want to access the first row in the array. So I want to use that row here. And why I didn't use this at the beginning, because I don't know how many drive, because as soon as you plug USB drive, the list will change. I will never know where that drive is going to be on the list. So that's why I had to filter first on the D drive. And after that, when there's only one, I know it's on position zero because there's only one item on the list. And the dot allow me to access a specific column. So we'll be using the name of the new column that I created. So free space in gigabyte. Press enter. Again, nothing will happen because I took the output of that and saved it into that variable. But if I type the name of the variable and press enter, voila, I get the number I was looking for, 840. So now I can test, if you want, that variable in my script to say if that variable is smaller than one, do the following, something like that. And if I go look at the type of the type of variable that the PowerShell decided to use, if I type get type, public, and this one is an integer. So PowerShell recalled that when I did that command here to have that number an integer. So when I extract that information, it will say it's an integer. So it will configure that variable to accept integer. If you switch around like text numbers and stuff like that, PowerShell will do his best to convert between what you ask him to do. If he can't, he will give you an error message. So this is an example of what PowerShell can do. Any questions?
No, there weren't any in the chat, Stefan. Yeah. Okay, thanks very much, Stefan.
Oh, hold on. There is next step.
Oh, one question.
So, go ahead.
How do you create commandlets? Do you create commandlets out of commands in PowerShell?
Or? Yeah. So you just build a text file, and you can put all of these commands, like whatever, like if I go back here, whatever I type here, I could have typed this in a text file, save it with a .1 extension, and when I run that command, that file, it will basically run that script, and I can build a program. Like you can have many instructions, as many as you need to achieve what you're trying to do. So if there's no more question, if there's enough interest, PowerShell special topic group, recurring Zoom meeting could be set up, and we can basically learn PowerShell all together. The topic and frequencies of the meeting would be discussed among those indicating an interest. To reduce the workload, if there is available expertise, volunteer could present a PowerShell topic to the rest of the group. So if you're interested that we create such a group, just let us know by sending your name via email to the OPCUG suggestion bus email. With the subject PowerShell special topic group by the 1st of February, and we'll see if there's an interest or not.
Okay, thanks very much, Stefan. So we'll let people do that. And now we're going to move on to an item from Chris, where he has a clock that's possessed.
Sorry, we're just going to finish on a little bit of a lighter note. My normal wake-up routine at my house is that I call out, "Hey, Google, good morning." And then next, what happens is my Lenovo smart clock, which is powered by the Google Assistant, it turns on the light, states the date and time, gives me the current weather as well as prediction for the weather for the rest of the day, reads off my calendar events for the day, and streams a radio station. Next. So after a while, I'll get up. And I tell the smart speaker to stop streaming the radio. And I turn on a clock radio I have in my computer room. I then go make my breakfast, bring it into the computer room, catch up on my email and various things like that, play some games and so forth. And normally I end up leaving the radio playing Boom 99.7 just all day, whether I'm in the computer room or not. Next. Then I found all of a sudden, randomly throughout the day, all of a sudden I'd hear the smart clock in my bedroom would start streaming music. And I thought it was kind of odd that it would all of a sudden do it by itself. It wasn't a huge problem. I could just yell out, "Hey, Google, stop streaming," and it would turn off. Next. But I wondered, well, did I have another automated routine that somehow was kicking in? I didn't think I did, but maybe I had been testing something and forgot about it. Or had my network been hacked and someone was telling my smart clock to start playing things to just to annoy me? So I decided I should look into it a little bit more. And so the answer finally came to me. The other day I was working at my computer and the radio was on.
And Elizabeth says it was Alan.
Yeah. So the radio in my computer room was on and all of a sudden the announcer came on and said, "Forget about asking your smart speaker to do things it can't do, like answer, 'Can I die from eating belly button lint?' and ask it things it can do, like Google start play Boom 99.7. And sure enough, next, the Lenovo smart clock in the bedroom next door announced playing Boom 99.7 and started playing it. So problem solved. All I have to do is as soon as I hear the radio announcer saying, "Forget about asking your smart speaker," I turn it off. Wait a couple of seconds, turn it back on again, or I just tell the smart clock to stop playing streaming music after it turns it on.
You need to join the PowerPoint special interest group, Chris, or PowerShell special interest group, and write a macro that will defeat that.
I don't know if you saw that news, but there was a guy, I don't know where he is, but he put sensors on his... called these small fish, like regarding the type of fish were in the aquarium. And when the fish was going in certain location, it was triggering commands that it was sending to respond to play games. So basically the fish was playing a game. But the game crashed, but the fish keep moving in the aquarium and was sending commands still to the phone, and he start buying other games. So the guy got a huge credit bill for all of these games that this fish bought, basically.
Okay, so we had lots of stuff tonight. We don't have time for more questions, so I'm just going to skip over to this. Our February meeting on February the 8th is all about how to get paid software for free. And Serge Aric is going to tell us how to do that. But before we get there, next week will be another Q&A session. So if you do have questions or if you have topics which you'd like to share, and I apologize to Tom Trottier, he was going to do a share on an app called Podcast Addicts. And we'll have to postpone that till next week. So if you have questions or if you have topics that you'd like to share with the group, and if you want to sign up with Stefan for a PowerShell special interest group, send an email to suggestionbox@opcud.ca. And thanks very much for attending. Hope you enjoyed it, and we'll see you all next week.
Thanks, folks.
Thanks. Have a good week.
Have fun with the snow.
Yes.
I have to pick up Linda at the airport tomorrow night. I hope planes are flying.
I hope we've dug the road out by then, too.
Yeah. I think it's going to be just a steady snow most of the day. It'll be a lot, but I think they'll be able to keep up with it.
Well, they're actually only talking about 10 to 15 centimeters, so that won't be too bad.
Yeah.
It'll be bad while it's snowing and windy, I guess, but once they get it cleared up, it's not really a big deal.
Ottawa Weather Records tweeted the other day as a poll asking, what do you consider to be a heavy snowfall? Some like 2 or 3% of the people actually said over 1 centimeter. There was only, I think, 45% that answered over 25 centimeters was what they would consider to be heavy. So there's quite a few people that were answering what I consider to be relatively light snowfalls, or certainly not considered to be heavy snowfalls, and they were considering it that way. So a lot of wimps out there, I guess.